Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't, today is Wednesday, October the 29th, 2025, and this is episode 3756 of the Survival Podcast. It is a Thursday, for you anyway. That means it is time for an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. Trying to get ahead and have a lot of stuff to set up, it's actually Wednesday afternoon for me, so I just got off a marathon, 2.5 hours with C.J. Kilmer, but I shall do my best for you today so I can have this podcast ready to go and self-publish tomorrow automatically. And so if there's any faintness in my voice or anything, I'm just worn out. But I'll do my best, and there might be a little less additional commentary as I go between the experts. Usually I have at least half of them that I have a significant add-on to. Today I'm going to probably just make this easy on myself and get it out for you so you have a new show, because next week will be 100% rewinds, which I still have to do two more of those. So, yeah. Anyway, what do we got today? Well, Chris Rossini and Dr. Ron Paul will ask a question. And I'm the one putting the effing in this, right, okay? But basically the discussion is, are we going to go to war with effing Venezuela? I mean, I don't care if you like the head of Venezuela or not, or you like Venezuela. Do we need to be engaging militarily with Venezuela? Why are we acting like we're going to? Personally, I don't think we're going to. But this is another one of those things like, will you shut up? I'm talking to Trump. Right? Like, will you shut up? Why are you doing this? I don't know. It's like madman government or something. And I don't know if he has some mindset behind it, but this is dumber than Canada being the 51st state. And that's not an easy mark to hit. Then Ryan Steva has some advice for you on choosing and maintaining a snowblower. This is quite timely. Snow will be here soon. Matthew Sursley will talk about how you handle items for review from a tax stance. I will have an add-on with this one because there's the lawyer's answer and then there's the pragmatic answer. John Pugliano will talk about gold, silver, Bitcoin, and the economy as a whole. Joe Riles will talk about dogs, as always, but in this case, starting training a brand new young, not a puppy, dog that has no training. In a lot of ways, this can be more difficult than just training a puppy because they have had more time to reinforce the idea that they get to make all the decisions, and training a dog is teaching them that you get to make the decisions. He's got some good advice on that. I've been through this. Lucy came to us. She was about 18 months old. Exactly the kind of stuff Joel will talk about we had to deal with her. Andy McCann will talk about why the real estate business is actually pretty easy and a good idea. Andy McCann, real estate. I thought he was a CrossFit fitness and diet guy. Yeah, he's also a real estate investor, and I talk about business and income and entrepreneurship all the time. Here's a great business model to look at. And then speaking of business models, it's been a long time since I've answered the question, Jack, what do I do if I want to start a podcast? Well, it turns out a member of Dorothy's family read my book and loved it, recommended it to a friend. He's actually a physicist. He wants to start a podcast as a physicist, and he sent me an email, and he wants me to answer this question for him. Since I haven't done it in a while, I thought, well, here's how you kill two birds with one stone. I'll make it my anchor piece today. I'll shoot him a quick email with a link to today's show, and then he can get a more full answer. Because my basic answer, and I'll tell you, there's a guy on the air with me today, John Pugliano. He's a great guy, expert council member, been on the show many, many times. He started a podcast about 10 years ago. Do you know what my entire advice to John was? Just do it. Nike, man. Just get on. Like, what are my tips and tricks? Don't ask me any of that. Just go do it. You'll figure it out. However, I do like to give out, like, well, what equipment do I use and what platforms and all that stuff, right? So I'm not going to do a course on it, but I can do about a 10-minute answer here with some additions, because I realized when I started thinking about this, I've not actually answered this question on the air since I started using StreamYard and doing lives. And the truth is, today I would do things differently than I did in the past. Even if I didn't do lives, I would do lives. What the hell could that possibly mean? When I get to my segment, I'll explain it, and I think it will make perfect freaking sense. With that, let's go ahead and start out by hearing from Chris Rossini and Dr. Ron Paul on are we going to go to war with effing Venezuela? Has Trump cracked his skull? What's going on here?
Well, I think two things are happening here with Venezuela, and we've talked about it a lot because I think it's very important. It's very clear that there are people in the administration who now are in the ascendance who want a war against Venezuela. They want a regime change war. And there's a lot of reasons I believe that is appealing to President Trump right now. He's having problems in Ukraine, obviously. He's basically fouled that up. When he was inaugurated, he was on the 2-yard line. He could have just run it in for 6, but he didn't. He wanted to run around the entire other way and then come back to the touchdown line. So he's got a problem there. The Middle East peace, everyone knows, is hanging by a thread. The ceasefire is violated every day by the Israelis. That's not a lasting peace, even though he says it'll last for 1,000 years. There's not much there. The economy, obviously, big problems at home. He wants a quick win overseas so that he can point to a victory. And what they're trying to do to achieve that is to conflate the 20-plus year, we would say, failed war on terror, because terror won, right? We have al-Qaeda in charge of Syria right now. But nevertheless, that feeling of the war on terror, now they're trying to transfer it to Venezuela. Maduro is the new Saddam Hussein. You have the WMDs are now fentanyl, right? The same sort of thing. He's running a criminal gang. We've got to take him out. And they're doing that while at the same time drawing the nostalgia of what they believe, I guess they think Americans don't have a long memory, was a great successful little war, and that was George Herbert Walker's Bush's attack on Panama and subsequent arrest of Noriega, who of course was a paid CIA agent officer, and to arrest him.
It looks to me like there might be a declaration of victory by the neocons. I mean, we were hoping that they would be held in restraint, but it looks like they have been winning. And when you see that the neocons are on the Sunday morning programs and all this, you have to wonder about it.
Yeah, I think President Trump probably doesn't want necessarily to do this regime change war. The problem is he's not interested in a lot of details. He's very, very susceptible to flattery. And what's the neocons' one greatest ability, which is to flatter people? Remember, they did that with President George W. Bush. They flattered him to high heaven to get him to do what they wanted. I think Trump is probably even more susceptible than George W. Bush was. So you can imagine how they're smothering him with flattery, because what they really want, what Rubio has always wanted, is this war on Venezuela.
I'll just say that if we were to do some sort of Noriega-like takeout of Maduro, it would not be as easy as Panama. Panama is a much smaller country. The United States military had a massive military presence in Panama. Almost the entire Panamanian military, the actual Panamanian military, was in a place called Fort Espinar, and they were all in their barracks, and it was basically a shooting gallery. It was actually a really easy, quick operation. That's Operation Just Cause. I'm not saying it was actually a just cause, but it wasn't hard to do. In fact, I was there shortly after it all went down, and the guys that were there for it referred to it as a live fire exercise. Venezuela wouldn't be that. It would be nowhere near as simple, and Maduro is nowhere near as unpopular as you have been told in Venezuela. That is a lie. Do a lot of people hate him? Yes. Do a lot of people hate Donald Trump? Yes. Did a lot of people hate Joe Biden? Yes. Did a lot of people hate Barack Obama? Yes. Did a lot of people hate George Bush? Yes. Did that mean if a foreign military invaded your country, you would have just been like, oh, okay. Yeah, no. I don't think he's going to do this. I don't know what the game is here. I've got to the point where I don't even try to figure out what the fuck Trump's doing anymore. And the reason I don't do it is because there's no logic behind what he's doing at this point. It doesn't make any sense. There's been times where I'm like, okay, well, maybe he's trying to, and then it's just like, no, that wasn't it either. Well, shit, I tried to figure out any logical reason to do what the hell you're doing, and I can't figure it out. I can't figure out why we keep propping up Ukraine, if you want that to end. I really can't. There's just so much this man says that is so effing retarded, I don't know what to think anymore. And I'm going to stop trying to figure it out. I hope we don't do this. Now, let me tell you why we might. If we were to do this with Venezuela, and somehow install a puppet government that answers to us and gives us completely favorable terms with their oil, between all the American energy that has been unleashed and the Venezuelan oil fields, which are massive, we would not have to worry about oil for... You'll be dead before you'd have to worry about oil in this country because of declining use plus the expanded supply. We seem to like invading countries that have extra oil reserves. We just seem to like that. It would be much easier to manage U.S.-controlled extraction in Venezuela than somewhere like, you know, Iraq. I'm just saying. So, sadly, and it would be a very big distraction, and if he believes it's an easy victory, every president loves to go to war and win. They really do. And people with egos, and that man, like, his biggest problem is his ego. And I probably don't mean it the way most people think that. I mean, especially people with TDS. I mean that everything he does, he has to talk about himself. Doesn't matter where he goes, who he's talking to. And yet, everybody's saying it. And they can't believe it. They've never seen nothing like it. You're supposed to be introducing a foreign dignitary to talk about his country, and you're talking about just on and on. He even did that at the Charlie Kirk Memorial. I don't understand. You would think it's not about whether he's a good guy or a bad guy. You'd think at this point in his life he would have more political savvy to know what not to say and when not to say it. But nope, not at all. Anyway, moving on to something a little bit more practical, let's talk about snowblowers with Ryan Steva, the Homestead Consultant.
Hey, TSP community. This is Ryan Steva from thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today I've got a question from... Well, I actually don't have a name. I've got a handle. So it's JetSki2. So JetSki2, if you're out there listening to this, this is the question you sent in. JetSki asks if any of the council members know about consumer grade snowblowers and mentions that they just picked up their first snowblower. And I'm wondering what sort of spare parts to pick up and any basic tips. So I think I can cover this decently. I grew up in the home of a lifelong mechanic, and I lived in Wisconsin most of my life, Minnesota for a while, before I moved to Tennessee. So I have some experience with snowblowers, so hopefully I can give some helpful information here. First of all, let's start with some of the things you might want to have around the home just in case you need them for the snowblower. Especially with snowblowers, you're going to want them when you have a storm come through, which is oftentimes when you can't get to the store. So this is actually a great question. You're going to want extra spark plugs. You're going to want extra shear pins. So there's going to be shear pins on these snowblowers that if they pick up a rock or an ice ball or whatever, it shears the pin rather than damaging the other parts or the engine. So you want to have extra shear pins so that you can replace those as needed. Make sure to have extra drive belts. So whether you have one or two, make sure that you have the appropriate drive belts to replace what's already on the machine if you need to. I always recommend just having a carburetor on the shelf for any engine you have. They're so inexpensive, anywhere from $15 to about $30 on Amazon. They're not going to be OEM parts, so you want to keep the OEM or the original carburetor in really good condition. But having one of these carburetors that you could just swap on and go if something happens would be really useful. Generally speaking, I always say have an extra fuel filter around. Usually these are fairly universal and can be used for mowers and other power equipment as well. Recoil starter rope is a good one to have around. A lot of these ropes actually get really brittle in the cold, and if they're sitting around for 8-9 months before you use them, you might have a rope that's gone bad, and when you go to pull it, it's going to break. So have an extra cord around to put on if you need to. Skid shoes are important. Those wear out quite quickly, especially if you're on like a gravel or concrete driveway. They really wear out quickly. A scraper bar, so that's the bar on the bottom of the unit, is intended to be a sacrificial part of the snow blower, so you want to have an extra one of those to swap out when you need to. You may also consider having an extra spark plug wire for your specific unit, though I find those to be less likely to go bad and probably less important to keep around. A couple other things to note that you want to do just tip-wise is make sure that you're using 100% gasoline in the unit. That will do a lot as far as keeping your carburetor clean and in good shape. And every time you use the unit, what I would recommend is shutting off the fuel or the fuel line, making sure you have a fuel line shut off. Shutting that off and letting the engine run until it's run all of the gas out of the carburetor. This is true for pretty much any small engine, your lawnmowers or pressure washers or whatever. Making sure you have extra engine oil around for the correct version, the weight, viscosity, and things for your specific equipment is a really good idea. Having some type of grease or oiler or lithium spray is important. Some of these better snowblowers will actually have grease points, but if they don't, you want to make sure to keep all of the moving parts greased and lubricated so they don't seize, as well as to keep them from wearing down as quickly. I would recommend having some spare cotter pins or other clips or things that might fall out or get lost as you're doing repairs. It's just generally good to have those things around. And then finally, depending on where you're keeping your snowblower, if you need to keep it warm, you can get little magnetic block warmers. And so you can keep that block warmer plugged in against the engine until you're ready to start it, and then you pull it off because it's magnetic. It's just a simple resistive warmer that you plug into the wall. Those can be really great to help you getting your snowblower started in cold temps. It will make pulling a lot easier, and it will get the engine up temperature a lot more quickly. Well, Jetski, I hope that helps. Let me know if you have any other questions, but hopefully that gets you started.
All right, moving on. Let's now hear from Matt Sersley on the concept of if you run some kind of podcast, YouTube channel, something like that, and then somebody decides, hey, I'm going to give you a product to review. How does that affect you from a tax standpoint? And like I said, you're going to get a lawyer's answer here with plenty of options to mitigate or eliminate any tax consequences. Now, I'm going to give you a redneck answer after Matt's done. And it doesn't have anything to do with his answer being incorrect. There's just when you have a license to practice law and you're asked a question like this, you're obligated to say certain things. Things that I'm not obligated to say. I'll leave it at that, and we'll hear from Matt first.
Hey, TSP crew. This is Matthew Sersley with AgoristTaxAdvice.com, here to talk about saving money on taxes. In particular, today we're talking about when you get free gear from companies for review purposes. So the question, what are the tax implications for receiving a product from a company for review or testing? If I use it in my business or for content creation, is there a way to structure things to avoid taxes? Details. I know that like-kind is the standard used for gifts or for received promotional items. However, is there a way to label or structure one's content creation within a business to legally avoid these tax implications? Well, a couple clarifications first. First of all, if this is truly a gift, there are no tax consequences to the receiver of a gift. However, these are almost certainly not gifts. Gifts are something given with no expected return or obligation. In this case, if they are giving it to you and the expectation is that you review it and do a video, then it's not a gift. The other thing is it's not like kind that's used. It's fair market value. The fair market value of what you receive is what is going to be used to determine how much income, if any, this is worth. Now, let's start off. Anything you receive in exchange for work or promotion is taxable. IRS Code 61 says all income from whatever source derived counts as income. That means property. So legally, if a company gives you, say, a $200 item expecting a review or mention, that's barter. They paid you a $200 item in exchange for your review. Now, there are some legitimate exceptions. Again, if it is truly a gift with no expectation of return, not taxable. If it is some sort of a sample that is used up in the review, then it's also not going to be taxable. So, for example, if they give you, I don't know, a cleaning thing that's used up in the test, that's not going to be considered taxable income. If it's a loan or a test unit that must be returned, it's not taxable. And no, you can't structure it that, oh, yeah, it has to be returned, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Well, if you don't return it, it's considered taxable. Finally, if the product has no resale or business value, then the fair market value might be zero. So, for example, if you have a company that does window washing and they send you a lawnmower, well, that has nothing to do for your business. There is no market value for that in your business, and therefore potentially you could call the fair market value zero. If an item is of such poor quality, you consider it to be worthless. Similarly, you could say the fair market value is zero, no income. That said, you're maybe overcomplicating it because there's another way to avoid the taxes on this. But when you do this as a business, and this is why businesses are kind of great, you report the fair market value as income, but then you can deduct that exact same fair market value as a business expense or with depreciation if it's equipment that you keep using. So let's say you get a $500 camera for review and you're a photographer. You use cameras in your business. Well, you report that camera as $500 of income, but then you write off that $500 camera as a business expense. Remember, this is essentially legally the exact same thing as if they gave you $500. You took that $500 and went and bought a camera with it and then used that camera in your business. Now, if you don't use it in your business or don't keep using it in your business, it's a little bit trickier. Maybe you can't write it off. It's also a little trickier if you're a very large company, and by large company, I mean over $2 million a year in revenue. There are limits to what you can expense versus depreciate, or, and you should be so lucky that this is an issue, if they give you a $50,000 truck, well, you can't expense a vehicle. You have to depreciate that. So you're not going to take that full $50,000 in the first year you get it. Frankly, I think that would be a great problem to have. Now, you want to document this really well. Document what you received, when, what you consider the fair market value, and whether it was returned, destroyed, or used in the business. So yes, these items are technically taxable, but that does not mean you're stuck paying extra taxes. As long as you really are using them in your business, whether for videos or demos or testing or actually, you know, taking a hammer and using it out in the field or something, you can typically deduct that value right back out. The important part is to track this for the fair market value and use consistent accounting. Now, many people skip this. They know that it cancels out, and so they don't report the income, they don't report the expenses. That's technically improper, and if the IRS catches you doing that, they can say you owe on that income, and since you didn't expense it and you didn't keep records of the expensing, you may not be able to deduct it. Frankly, I've not really ever heard of that happening. So if you just ignore it, you probably won't get in trouble, but the lawyer in me has to say that's not the proper way to do it. So when you get free stuff for your business, it isn't really free, but if you handle it right, it's usually not going to cost you any money either. Now, you all know I've worked with many business owners to cut their tax bills by thousands, tens of thousands, in a few cases, hundreds of thousands of dollars. But recently, I've started to work with anybody who's paying more than $30,000 a year in federal income taxes, including high-earning W-2 employees. So if that's two, please reach out to me, and let's see if you're overpaying your taxes, and if so, by how much. Please head over to agoristtaxadvice.com/TSP. You'll get a free download to help you look at deductions, personal and business, and you'll also get a link to set up a free call with me. Thanks, everyone.
The big thing to ask here is how expensive is this? I know a guy that got basically an $80,000 value solar system, and there is no way there's not some documentation by that company of a demo expense or whatever, and he's highly likely to get some sort of like a 1099 or something out of that. Because it's such a large expenditure. And if it's something like that, you know, you need to look at some strategies that, like depreciation or something like that. But you're probably going to have to deal with it from the approach that Matthew came at. Let's say somebody sent you a knife worth $75. If you put that on your tax return, what the fuck are you doing? Right? There is such a thing as me, you, and the fence post for some things. So I think it depends on what you're doing. And I also think it depends on the frequency that you're doing it, how you decide to handle it. Some things just don't need to be, if there's no paperwork submitted to anybody, who the hell would know you're not that important? If you are a big channel or something, though, and like you're doing four or five reviews a week, you need to sit down with a tax strategy professional and figure out how to deal with this. And one of the things you might find out is that in some instances, if you don't just want a bunch of stuff, the concept of having something like it's a product for review that you return may be a good strategy because, you know, just I worked with Veever for a while. I still say you can buy from them. I still have them on my site, but there's some quality concerns there, so I stopped reviewing stuff. But I also ended up with, like, even though the stuff was really cool, like, how many of these things do I need? And I ended up with more. I gave a bunch of it away at the last workshop. Even some stuff I really liked, but I'm like, I don't need to have three griddles to cook on. So I gave away my Vivor griddle at the last workshop to somebody who wanted it. And, you know, so there's another angle I could see here, and I'm not sure how this would work from a tax standpoint, but if the company provided it as a prize item, in other words, you're going to review it, but you're just basically performing a function of content creation, and then somehow that item is going to get to your viewer, your listener, what have you. That might be a way that I don't see why you would have to pay any tax on it. You didn't get it. You didn't get to keep it. Now, exactly how to structure that, I don't know. That's where you want to talk to somebody like Matt, either Matt himself or whoever you use for stuff like this. But there are a lot of big channels that do kind of the borrow and return model. One of the really big gun channels, a lot of people pick on the guy. He's a boomer, a little bit older than me, but old man or whatever. You know, he's a, what do you call it? What is the word people use for people like this? A FUD, right? A FUD is a Hickok 45. I really like Hickok, but I've noticed that a lot of times he'd be like, we have the brand new Winchester or whatever, and it's on loan from Bud's Gun Shop. So he'll send it to him, and he'll send it back. And I know when you're new to this, you think getting a lot of product is a good thing, and it can be. But in the end, you're in business to make money, not get free things. And so you might want to figure out some way to channel, and then, like, you can cherry pick, like, yeah, I want this, and yeah, I want that, but why create a potential tax burden and end up with just a pile of stuff sitting around? I will also say this, though. I know a lot of people that do this, and I don't know any of them that reported on their taxes. You do with that information, as you will. Again, but none of the ones I'm talking about are like super big, well-known channels that do nothing but reviews. That's a different thing altogether. Next up, though, let's hear from John Pugliano on an update on the precious metals market. It's a little bit on Bitcoin and the economy as a whole.
Hey, TSP, want to get some quick answers in with the rise of precious metals? There's been a lot of questions around that, so I want to talk gold, silver, and a little Bitcoin, and then I want to circle back on the overall strength of the economy and particularly issues around the U.S. dollar. Now, that's a lot to get in, so I'm going to do it real quick. And as always with these segments, I probably can't fully answer your question. You can always feel free to reach out to me directly, and we can have a more thorough discussion. First off, in terms of precious metals, and particularly silver, we have a question from Bob. And he's looking at the run-up in silver, and he thinks maybe it's time to add some more. And the interesting thing is, we get a very similar question from Jake, but Jake's taking the opposite side of the argument. He's seen the run-up in silver. He thinks maybe it's time to sell some of his. What I just described to you is exactly what happens in markets. One person sees an opportunity to buy. Another person sees the opportunity to sell. Listen, over the short term, this stuff can fluctuate drastically. Over the long term, and I listen to what I say this cautiously, over the long term, we know the plan of the U.S. dollar is to keep it devaluating so that the debt can be paid off by, you know, inflating in a way, or what economists call monetizing it. So we know that's the long-term plan. It's been the plan since, you know, 1913. So over time, things like silver and gold will increase in value in relation to the U.S. dollar. But so will virtually any other asset, certainly assets that are appreciatory in nature, real estate, profitable companies, and new asset classes like Bitcoin that it's only been around for 17 years or so. And I'm sure that other innovations and technologies will come along as well that will increase in value in relation to the U.S. dollar. So whether you buy gold and silver now when they're off the record highs at this particular time, but, you know, whether you buy them now or not, if you're holding them for the long term, they're most likely more than going to hold their value, with one exception. And this is the big unknown that we never know about. There are cycles to these things. Pull up a long-term chart of gold. you can see that when it's driven up in a mania, I'm talking like 1979, 1980, it can then have a collapse and a stagnation in prices that literally lasts for 15 or 20 years. So it can be a long cycle if you buy it at the wrong time. Now keep in mind, too, on that chart on gold, that that's not inflation adjusted. So if you did buy gold at a peak in 1979, you not only had to wait until the early 2000s to get your money back in terms of the nominal value of gold, but really it's only been just recently that gold on an inflation-adjusted basis hit a new peak. In any case, I don't think that gold and silver are at the total peak levels like we had seen, you know, in the 1970s, 1980s. Not at this point yet. And that doesn't mean that we couldn't see a correction of, you know, 15, 20%. That's likely. But that wouldn't be a long-term decade-type recovery. I'll get to my rationale on that in a second. Let me transition here for a minute, though, and bring in a question from Tammy. Because although she's asking about Bitcoin ETFs, I think it's relevant to the overall discussion of gold and silver. Tammy owns a Bitcoin ETF in her Roth IRA. She's wanting to add more to it, and she's wondering, should she put it in IBIT, which is what it's in now, or should she use a different Bitcoin spot ETF, or, you know, maybe should she hold it in self-custody? The reason I want to use her question as a transition is because Tammy's a diversified investor. She's retired, she has a pension, she has Social Security, she has this broad investment portfolio, and specifically she wants to add to her Bitcoin. Tammy's not concerned about trying to buy in ahead of a breakout or, you know, not worried about the price of it falling apart while it's, you know, at some significant highs. She's just simply adding to it because it's part of her overall diversified, broad investment portfolio. I think that's the best approach you want to take in investing. Not trying to just get into gold or silver or whatever because they're about to break up to new highs, or not trying to sell off of them because they're going to fall apart. And to Tammy's specific question, and Tammy, to the fact that you own the Bitcoin ETF in your Roth, I think is really the best place you can put it. And that's just because of the tax-free nature of it. As far as whether you should use IBIT or one of the others, it doesn't really matter much. I mean, the whole point of Bitcoin is that it is fungible, you know, much like the stocks in the S&P 500. Whether you get a S&P 500 fund from Vanguard or Fidelity or Schwab, you know, there's a little bit of differences, but not enough to really make a huge matter. The one thing you want to look at is management fees of the ETF. Last time I looked at IBIT, it charged around 25 basis points, which isn't extreme for, you know, a targeted ETF like that. There are others like EZBC, which is a little less expensive. Again, probably not enough to make a difference. You know, your question about should you self-custody, I know a lot of people think, you know, no keys, no coins. Well, that's true, but really it all comes down to personal preference and ability. In terms of security, yeah, you could make the argument that self-custody is more secure. But I got to tell you, I have met a few people, actually probably many people, that in one form or another have lost some or all of their Bitcoin because the device was destroyed or because they forgot or lost their seed phrase. But I haven't met anybody that's lost their Bitcoin through an ETF or an exchange. So there's that. In any case, Tammy's doing it right because she has a diversified portfolio. She's not betting on just one horse. Now, to wrap this whole thing up, we had a question from Chris that sees the run-up in precious metals as a bad sign for the economy and for the value of the dollar. As I mentioned, I don't think we're necessarily in peak gold or silver at this point to the extent like we saw in the late 70s, where then the price totally collapsed, because a lot of the buying now, especially of the gold, is related to central banks, and they're trying to diversify from the U.S. dollar. A lot is made of that the U.S. dollar would lose reserve currency status, and I can't go into all the reasons why I don't believe that's true. The fact that gold has run up so much, and remember, it's not just in U.S. dollar terms, it's in any currency's terms, actually shows the strength of the U.S. dollar, because as the BRICS nations and others, particularly the Chinese, have tried to encourage the use of their currencies, the world isn't having that, right? They'd rather either have the U.S. dollar or they'd rather have gold. And the biggest driver of the flight to gold for central banks is not about a concern of U.S. debt or its inability to pay its debts, but rather that the U.S. dollar has been weaponized for, you know, at least the last generation. And the biggest event we saw was in 2022, when this latest surge in gold really started to take place. And that was when, you know, they kicked Russia off of SWIFT and they seized Russian U.S. dollar assets. So central banks aren't fleeing the U.S. dollar because they don't believe in the stability of the U.S. government or the U.S. economy, because frankly, as bad as the world is, the United States remains the tallest midget, right? The fear has been in sanctions, not in the U.S. economy. And you're seeing Trump trying to reverse a lot of that. He's doing that by relying less on sanctions. There's still sanctions, but he's relying less on sanctions and more on access to U.S. markets through tariffs. That actually acts to strengthen the dollar for a multitude of reasons. And then also, with the Genius Bill, creating altcoins that are pegged to the U.S. dollar is very likely going to create a demand for U.S. dollars that far exceeds even the largest central bank's holdings of U.S. dollars. So in effect, the altcoin strategy is a direct alternative to foreign central banks selling treasuries and buying gold, because the intent is to have their citizens, particularly in these less stable countries, to buy altcoins that are backed with U.S. dollars. It's a complicated topic. In any case, I keep a very small fraction of my overall net worth in U.S. dollars. I use it for transactions, whether it's to pay the monthly bills or to park my money in a money market fund until I make another investment. But the bottom line, regardless of what the U.S. dollar does, I own assets that I believe are going to appreciate more in value over time than the dollar depreciates. So again, if you have a diversified portfolio, it's a moot point. But hey, as always, thanks for your questions. Until next time, this is John Pugliano wishing you the very best returns.
Great stuff as always from John. On the ETFs on Bitcoin, you guys know my stance. If you have the money free and clear, don't buy an ETF. Buy Bitcoin. If you have the money in some sort of investment account or something like that, where it's captive and it's easier, if there is a significant penalty to acquire it outside of that, or you have to sell something and move it into another place, and just buy the ETF. There's nothing wrong with owning an ETF. What keeps everybody honest with Bitcoin isn't everybody self-custodying. It's that it can be done, and that so many people do it. Let me tell you something else. I have way less concern about you holding an ETF in like your Schwab account than I do you holding Bitcoin on an exchange in large amounts long term. That is my bigger concern. That is a far bigger concern for me than you holding, you know, something like BlackRock's IBIT. And it, just another thing for those that aren't familiar with jargon, 25 basis points is a quarter point. It's actually, if you're going to trade, it will cost you less to trade with an ETF than to trade with raw Bitcoin on exchange. That's one of the big advantages of the ETFs for high-frequency trading, is that the trading fees are higher than that quarter point. Just saying, like, you can trade in and out with those ETFs really, really inexpensively. At least that's my understanding. So I don't own any of them. I've not verified that, but that's my understanding from listening to other people in the industry. Moving on, let's go ahead and hear about training a brand new dog that's not new to the world. It's been around a while, not a long time, but it's still young, but not a puppy. And it don't know nothing, and you're trying to train it, and it may resist that. How do we deal with that? Joel Riles will talk about it.
Hello TSP crew, this is Joel coming back at you from Fortress Canine and Canine Academy. And today we have a question from Chris, and essentially what it boils down to is he got this new dog. It was a stray, looks like it's a lab mix. It's not a puppy, but it's young, still pretty high energy, and he's having some trouble getting started in his obedience and kind of getting things dialed in, right? And so he put some collars on the dog. It ran away, came back, no collars on. He's asking how to deal with that. And in general, he's just having a few issues getting this dog integrated in. So I wanted to kind of take a step back and go over a few things that we do when we have a new dog, whether it's a puppy, like this one right here being trained, or whether it's another dog, a stray, or one you got from a shelter or something like that. How do we get the dog started? Okay, so the first thing to remember and recognize is if a dog has been free, running around doing whatever it wants, right, and the pups do that either in their kennels or on their tie-outs, and then they come in and they have to start doing a thing. they are going to act kind of like, oh man, kind of a little bit depressed, a little bit upset about it. And if you go, oh, my dog's a free spirit, I'm just going to let them do whatever they want, you are never going to get obedience in that dog. Right? What you have to do with the dogs is, it's like having a child who's running around with forks and trying to stick them in sockets in your house. You have to take the forks away and put the child in a spot where they can learn discipline. Okay? So the dog has to learn discipline. Now, you can let it run off and be a free spirit and live its life, and you know what will happen? In a few years, that dog will be dead from starvation or disease. So, or you can bring it into your house, you can discipline and get it functional in your home, and then you can let it have a little bit more freedom if you decide you want to do that. All right? So how do we start a pup? Well, the first thing I do with them is I put a collar on them. And so this pup right here is wearing a biothane collar. Plex. Good Plex. He's wearing a biothane collar. So I use one of two flat collars. I like the biothane collars if you have your dog outside a lot, because they don't hold and they don't absorb and hold water. All right. So if they get wet, they don't hold water themselves. Now, their fur may hold a little bit of water and stuff like that, but these don't absorb water and hold it against the dog's neck. And if you have a collar that does that, the dogs can start getting hot spots on their neck from a collar that will absorb the water and then keep the neck moist for long periods of time, right? So these are from Gun Dog Supply. The other thing I like about them is they have this little brass plate here that you can put your contact information on. So if your dog does run away, at least, and if they still have their collar on, somebody will know and be able to contact you potentially, right? But when you put this on, you want to make sure it is snug enough that it's not going to pull off over their head, but you also want to make sure it doesn't choke them. Now, depending on your dog's neck versus head size and all that, you have to play around with that just a little bit. But you want to measure the dog's neck, get a collar that's going to fit them, and then make sure that the collar is snug enough that it won't pull off their head, but it's not choking them at the same time. Now, here's what I do day one, teaching them to deal with a collar, is I put the flat collar on, I clip a lead to it, or you can do a chain or a cable as well with this, and I tether them, and I just let them spend like half a day there. And now make sure there's shade, make sure they have water, all that good stuff. We're taking care of our dogs, but basically what's going to happen is they're going to try and run and do something they want to do. They're going to hit the end of the lead. It's a flat collar. It's not correcting them. And then they're going to go, what? What's this? No, I want to go do that thing. And they're going to pull and pull and tug and try and fight the lead. Now, I stick around close to them while they're doing this, because if they try to chew on the lead, I want to be like, hey, knock that off. Maybe give them a little bump on the snout. No, no, no. We don't chew on our leads, right? I don't want to get them into the habit of chewing leads right off the bat. And they'll fight this for 15, 20, maybe 30 minutes if they're really determined. And then they just kind of settle in. And usually what happens is they settle in a little bit, and then they kind of forget they're tied out, and they get up to go do something, and they hit the end of the lead again, and they're like, oh no! And they freak out a little bit, but then they calm down faster the second time. And after a couple of hours, they're just like, oh, okay, this is the space I can move in. Right? Because your lead's going to have like a diameter depending on how you tethered it. And they can move around in that area. Now, a couple things you're going to have to watch for is they'll sometimes tangle their legs up. So you might have to untangle them. Depending, like if I put them on a table here, like this table, they might move around the legs and then end up trapped, right? And so I have to fix that if they do that. So, but the whole point of this is I used to put the flat collar on the dogs and then go for walks and just hold the lead while I was walking. And that's fine if you have one dog. You can do it that way too. And if they fight, I just act like nothing's wrong. I just go, come on, we're going this way. And I walk wherever I'm going. And you know, if they run around me, I'll hand the lead around behind me. But they're restricted in their movement to being close to me, right? So this is getting them used to having a collar on, so they're not freaking out and flipping out every time they feel tension on the lead from the collar. The other thing you need to start doing right off the bat is building a bond with the dog. And this sounds like where Chris is having issues with his dog, right? Is right now there's no bond there with your dog. And so because there's no bond, he might be coming back because you give him pets. He might be coming back because there's food there. But he hasn't really connected with you yet. And if you're working with a dog and you want to keep this dog, you want to really connect with it. And the way you build a bond with a dog is you spend as much time as you can with it. All right? So I'm actually going to break his question up into a couple of segments, But we're going to go ahead and wrap this one up. So the first two things you do when you get a new dog or you start training a puppy is I want to introduce them to the collar. And I use a flat collar for this. I do not use a prong collar. I'm going to tether them or I'm going to hold the lead and go for a walk with them. And I'm just going to get them used to walking on a lead. Now, some of your dogs, when you go for a walk, if that's what you decide to do, they might like lock up with their back legs and like, no, I'm not going. And what I do in that situation is I just put the lead around my waist and I just keep walking, right? And what you'll notice is they might fight it for like 20, 30 seconds and then they'll kind of walk a little bit and fight and kind of walk a little bit and fight and then they'll just kind of walk and then they'll realize, okay, that's not working, right? If every time they lock up, you stop, they're going to be like, oh, all I have to do is lock up and he stops and then the tension goes away. It's like I want the dogs to learn the tension goes away when you walk with me. I'm not going to just make the tension go away if you're fighting me. The tension's only going to go away if you walk with me. On the tether, the tension goes away when you stop fighting the table or the foot post or the fence or wherever they're tethered to, right? So the idea is you don't want to reward the fight behavior. You want to reward the come with me behavior or the relax, this is your space you can be in behavior, right? So if they do that, keep walking. I know it can be a little bit of a pain sometimes depending on how stubborn your dog is, but I want to get them used to their collars. I want to start spending time with them and bonding with them. And this could be having a tie out on your porch and just spending time out there doing stuff with the dog, right? But you need to do this. It takes a couple days. About the third day, if you just spend several hours a day with your dog, you're going to notice kind of a big shift. And about that third day, every time they see you, they're going to be like, oh, this is so exciting. My person's here. Right? And they're going to start bonding to you at that point. And after 2 weeks, it's going to be a whole different story. They're just going to want to be with you all the time if they can. All right? But those are the first two things you do. And I'll be doing another segment right after this addressing some of the other questions that Chris had. If this has been helpful for you, check out canineacademy.us by going to Jack's website, thesurvivalpodcast.com, and clicking on the Canine Academy banner up there on his website. And we have lots of different options there for learning to train your dog. We address things just like this. It's all video-based, so you can see exactly what we're doing. And I talk you through everything that's happening while we're training the dogs. And if you're interested in getting a puppy or a fully trained dog, check out fortresscanine.com. If you missed it, Jack put up a blog post a little while back that we are having a Christmas sale on our puppies. We don't ever do sales on our dogs, but right now we're doing a Christmas sale on our puppies where the pups are $500 off, and that also applies if you get an advanced puppy where we start their obedience for you, but you still get the $500 off the puppy sale price. So if you're interested in that, check out fortresscanine.com. You can use the contact us or the consultation page to send me a message and I will reach out. All right, guys, until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
All right, next up, let's hear about investing in real estate from Andy McCann.
Hello and good morning, guys. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage. And yes, it is true, I am your health and fitness guy here on the Survival Podcast. But a couple of you guys have been listening to my podcast, Fitness, Food, and Finance. And in the finance section, I do talk about business and my main gig, which is rental property. So rental property is the bigger thing, the bigger moneymaker, because we've been doing it for so long. The gym is just something fun and exciting and everyone can relate with. So a question came in, and it wasn't Timmy, but he put in there Timmy because I always make the joke, it's Timmy. Anyway, so Timmy said, hey, what are the best things about the way rental property and being a landlord is done now and these days, and should I do it? So on the should you do it, I mean, that's on you. I don't know. I say yes because it's been a great business, but you really need to get in there with some capital and manage your risk. But your question of what makes it easy and what would you do and like what technologies are out there, I'll tell you this. The advent of Zillow is awesome. So if you've never used Zillow, go check it out. Go to Zillow.com and you can look up rental properties. You can look up for sales. You can look up, I mean, pretty much everything. And they pull all this data and bring it together. If you have a house and you list it with them, it'll even tell you this is what we estimate you should charge. Now, it's not a great thing to do a business based on estimates. Hey, Mike down there is charging $6. I should charge $6. You need to charge what you can make. The problem is, this is market demand, so it's a house is a house is a house. Unless you can come up with something super awesome. So I'll show you this. If you go into a neighborhood that I actually know really well, the Woodlands, there is a house for rent, several houses for rent, 2,500, 2,700, 2,400. And then there's one that's for rent for 4.4, so 4,400 a month. What are they doing different? I don't know. I'll do some research on that later because that's interesting. And maybe it's an executive suite. They got everything furnished. I don't know. But Zillow will show you everything. Not only will you be able to do your research on it, but you'll be able to do your advertising because they're looking for stuff. You're able to do your leases through them. You can even do your payments through them. They've got everything. It's a one-stop shop. All you have to do is the business. So this becomes the front-end tool that I don't even pay for. So this rental property industry that I'm into, it's the one business I have. I don't even have a website for. I use their stuff, and I post my stuff on their tool. Anyway, probably the next big thing is electronic fund transfers, so Venmo, PayPal, and Cash App, things like that. And the reason for that is what would happen in the past is someone would write you a check that then would bounce. So you can write checks that don't exist. Yeah, I know it's supposed to be some sort of a federal offense or something that's illegal, but people do it all the time anyway. I'm not sure how many people use checks anymore, so that's kind of maybe gone by the wayside, but this electronic fund transfer, they can't send you the money if they don't already have it. So it arrives to you, and it can't be untaken back. Now, the problem with electronic fund transfer, depending on the rules in your county, if a scumbag wants to stay in your house, usually there's a 60-day process that your county goes through to get them out. And if you accept or receive even $1, it resets that 60 days. So this is something somebody could do to kind of like almost legally stay in your house. I asked a lawyer about this, and he said, well, you could try sending the money back, but I haven't really been through a case like that. So that's an iffy play. So maybe there's a downside to the electronic fund transfer, but I haven't found it. So far, it's been awesome. The last thing, and probably the biggest one, is the advent of YouTube. YouTube, you can literally put in anything, and it'll tell you, this is how you fix it. So I'm going to type something in here. I'm going to type, there's a thumping in my HVAC's air compressor, and let's see what it comes up with. Okay, so I typed something like that, and it put in there five common AC noises and what they mean. Air conditioner noises and loud. Loud bang when I turn on the AC. So, and the fixes that go with it. So you can literally fix anything, and you can go to any like a site like repairparts.com and get these parts. You just take a picture of what you know the item is, and then go on there and find it. It's super easy and super quick. So I do everything all myself, and I fix everything myself. Now, it is a tough business to get started with because money will always be tight, right? That's just how these things go. You got to figure out how to adjust your finances on that. Read Robert Kiyosaki's Rich Dad Poor Dad. You can figure that out. I also like Dave Ramsey, so put those two guys together. So the thing that people will not really emphasize on that I think is a great piece is that let's say you get a house and the mortgage is, I don't know, $2,000 a month, just whatever it is. You bought something, it's $2,000 a month. You decide to rent it for $2,001 a month. So technically you're making $1. I know. You're actually losing money because of all this other stuff. But let's just say it's working out perfectly. So you're making $1. Next year, you'll probably raise the rent and your mortgage will stay the same. Yes, your taxes will go up, but not that much, right? So you raise your rate by 10%. So now it's $2,200 and maybe your your taxes went up a few percent. So, or not percent, it went up in dollars. So maybe, it's $50 extra in taxes. So you start widening the gap between your expenses and your incomes because time is on your side. So I've got houses that we rented, we bought back in like the year 2000. And I think we started off renting it like $1,200 and now they rent for $2,400. So it's us 25 years of increase. And yeah, it's been great. So these are the tools at your disposal. If you have more questions about rental property, I'm happy to answer them. I know I'm the food and expert or the health and fitness expert guy, but rental property is actually what I do most of my time. All right, y'all, take care.
All right, so time for my topic, which is going to be about starting a podcast. And this is a question I've answered an awful lot over the years. And, honestly, I was thinking about it, and maybe once I get through this workshop, I'll put together a page on the site that has, like, links to the equipment and services that I use and formalizes a little bit more, because I do get this question quite a bit. But I'm going to lead off with the number one way that I answer it. Go do it. There's There's literally a million podcasts plus in the world today. My 14-year-old grandson, with very little guidance, was able to do a podcast for a while. It didn't turn out to be something he really wanted to keep doing, but he was able to do it. If you want to do a podcast today, you can do it. And anything you need to learn, you'll learn by doing it. I'll put it this way. You cannot learn to drive a car sitting in a parking lot. You have to get behind the wheel, turn the key, put the damn thing in gear, and try not to mess things up too bad while you're driving it. I know when you're driving a car, someone sits next to you and tells you what to do and what not to do, tries to help you learn. But in the end, you learn by doing. And anything you're trying to figure out how to do, there is a YouTube video, how do I fill in the blank, and it will tell you, or use AI, ChatGPT, how do I. Now, sometimes you'll get wrong information because it's based on the past versus the present, and you might have to, like, of a software service or something, you might need to find out they moved a feature. But overall, you can do it. And proof of that is there are multiple people who podcast who have come to me with the question, what is the secret to the success of a podcast? Who have successful podcasts today who I gave a three-word answer to, just do it. It's actually a four-word answer because there was a word that starts with F and rhymes with truck in there with an ing at the end of it, okay? But that's the answer I gave John Pugliano. That's the answer I gave C.J. Kilmer, who was on the show yesterday. Just go do it. So if you think like I hold back because I have secret sauce, I don't want to share anything, the reality is the podcast is different than just about every type of media, unless it's old media trying to play in the new media space, which they're increasingly doing. Every host on Fox News has a podcast and everything. It's the same shit, they just put it in RSS feed and stick it on the podcast network. That's not a podcast. That's just a different way of distributing your same old boring slop that is put together professionally but is nothing innovative, new, or different. It's the same content that they put on Fox News or CNN or whatever, or ESPN or what have you. Those are not podcasts in my view. And it's maybe it's because I'm an old fart podcaster. I've been podcasting since 2008. The oldest continuous running podcast I know of is No Agenda. Adam Curry's podcast. Of course, Adam is very well known as a VJ on MTV from the 80s. He's been on this show, actually, with me. And he literally is the podfather. He created podcasting as we know it today because he's the one that created the technology to feed it into RSS feeds the way that it's done today. He's the one that got Apple to put it into their distribution model, right? So we owe, if you're a podcaster, you owe a lot to Adam. And if you become one, you will always owe a lot to Adam. But he's the one, I had a conversation with him offline about this, that it is different being a podcaster. It's like instead of being the waiter at a restaurant or the cook at the restaurant or the greeter at the restaurant, you're all of the above and you grew the food. And you transported it. You create the entire experience as a podcaster if you're doing it right. And the beauty of that is you have that creative freedom. The problem with that is it really isn't a paint-by-numbers system. I can't tell you the format for your show or what it should be or how you should do it. I can give you some ideas, but that's about it. You won't really know what it's going to become until you birth it. You really won't. When you create a podcast, it's like having a child. An infant, when it holds its head up and crawls, you've accomplished something. That's two or three people listening to it. And it will take on, if you build an audience, and if you build an audience that's more than just people that listen, a community around it, they will start helping to shape it, and they will do some things with your child that maybe wasn't what you had envisioned for it. You wanted your child to go to Harvard and be an attorney, and next thing you know, little Johnny's going off and learning how to weld and fabricate stuff, and he's building some kind of beautiful sculptures for $10,000 a sculpture, or something else. What I'm saying is you cannot know what's something you create that on some levels will have a life of its own because other people will be involved and they will pull and they will tell you what they want and you should listen to them within reason and make them feel like they're part of what you're doing. If you really want to understand what it's like to birth the podcast, as bad as the audio is, get on my site, go back to June in the archives, June of 2008, listen to the first 50 episodes, listen to it suck and get better over time, listen to me figure it out, listen to it form, right? But overall, just go do it, and realize when you're listening to it, it's 17 years. The world has changed. You have technology today that you didn't have. So, like I always used to recommend for a microphone, a Samson CO1U USB studio condenser microphone, which I don't anymore, even though I'm talking to one right now. I actually run two machines with two different microphones. I don't do any mixing boards or anything like that. But today, there's a better product available. And the plug-and-play USB microphone that I know the most fellow podcasters that use today is Blue Yeti. So get a Blue Yeti microphone. They're about $120. Totally worth the money. I record when I'm straight up recording like I do for these shows where they're not online. I still use Audacity. I've been using Audacity forever. If you have a Mac and you want to use it on a Mac, there's like an extension thing you have to do. I don't remember how. But I have Audacity on my PC side where I do my editing and what have you. So I use that old microphone on that. If it crapped the bed and I needed a new mic, I'd buy another Blue Yeti like I use with my live streams. It's just a better sounding microphone. It's a more efficient microphone. And the Samson is very old. It's so old that I got my first one in 2009. So I would go with the Blue Yeti, and it's got some more control available to it. That's the microphone I would recommend. For recording, if you're just going to straight up record audio, yeah, Audacity is great. It's probably the best tool for the job. However, if I was starting a podcast today, I would use StreamYard just like I do for all my live streams. And there's a strong case to be made for even a standalone do-it-by-yourself podcast. Like I do two of those a week usually, and I'm still live on YouTube. Do all your stuff live on YouTube. I don't think having a YouTube channel is having a podcast. A lot of people say that today. If it doesn't go in an RSS feed, if it doesn't go into Spotify and all the other things, I don't consider it a podcast. I say it just a YouTube channel. It's an additional marketing funnel for podcasters. I would recommend today that everybody start with StreamYard, set up a dedicated channel on YouTube, a dedicated page on Facebook. And the cheapest StreamYard subscription will let you stream to Facebook, to YouTube, and one more destination. Okay? So then I would then set up, of the things that are available to do that with, one on Rumble. Rumble doesn't have the censorship of YouTube. Even a podcast like the guy that wants to do, that I'm answering this question for, he wants to do it on physics, you can still end up getting censored. Rumble will never censor. Well, I'm going to say Rumble never will censor you. If Rumble censors you, you've gone way, 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 way outside. Like all the crap that happened during COVIDs and all, like that, they didn't censor shit. That's kind of their differentiator. They can't. I don't think they ever will because it's their only value add that they have. They don't have as big an audience for you. Live streaming there costs you $10 a month if you want to live stream to it. I would pay the money. It's $120 a year. So how do you get people to come to that platform where if you're not a Dan Bongino, you're going to have a much smaller audience? Well, you guarantee them that you're not going to censor them. And if you start censoring them, you lose what you have. So that's the beauty. So I would stream to those three places. If you want to go higher, the next step on StreamYard is 7 destinations you can stream to. It costs a little bit more money. I wouldn't start there because you don't know if you're going to keep doing it. But at that point, then you can add things like Twitch, and you know if you're on Facebook, you can stream to your personal Facebook, and you can stream to like your Facebook page that's branded, and you can decide how many places. But no matter what, I would at least get on StreamYard and stream to Facebook and YouTube. When you do that, when you're finished with no editing, your content is up and live immediately because it was live broadcast, okay? If you want to put out an audio show, and I really recommend you do because you're not really a podcaster till you do, you can then download that audio file and then you can publish it as a podcast. You want to do that on a blog. For your blog, you want to use WordPress. It has integrated RSS. You can get a plugin is what it's called for podcasting. I'm not going to go into every individual thing, but you get a podcasting plugin and you drop your audio, upload your audio file, drop it in there. Write up some show notes, links, anything you promise your audience. Good show art is nice. You can make that with Midjourney. Makes the best show art. I use ChatGPT to generate prompts, and I take the prompts from ChatGPT and I put it over in Midjourney, and I play with it until I get a thumbnail I really like. In the beginning, you don't need that. Make yourself one stock thumbnail to go on YouTube, and I use ImageFlip Pro, so I can take the thing off. That's $5 a month. I use that to put my episode title and episode number and all that stuff on it. You can just look at my site and see how they look when you do that. These are all things you'll learn. Now, most of the stuff I'm telling you, I didn't do back when I started. Back when I started, I recorded it. I made a post on the blog. I dropped the file onto the server. I put the link to that in the extension. And I hit publish. And that's it. And that's how I built my show. But today we have all these other tools that you can leverage and move so much faster. So that's the way that I would come at this. Some just general advice, though, because I can't, in a 10-15-minute segment, give you like all the technical tools. I will tell you that I do my editing with a program called Sony Vegas. It's very expensive. It's over $1,000. I had it for video editing, so audio editing on is fabulously easy for me. There's many other tools. I don't know what I would use. I've done editing with Audacity. It's okay. It's free, and it's Audacity, Audacity. But it's a little clunky to me. Now, if I use it every day, I might not feel that way anymore very quickly. But I am very, very fast. I mean, I have people all the time, Jack, we'll edit your podcast for you. It would take me longer to get you the files than to do it. Because all I'm doing is taking that audio file off of StreamYard, dropping it into Vegas, and putting music on both ends. And that's what I recommend, is record your podcast in StreamYard. Stream it to the platforms, okay? Grab the and then download audio only and put that on your blog side and then publish that. Then set up social media and promote it and all the other things, because that's a marketing thing of itself. On your podcast, though, this is something that has not changed. It's my philosophy, and I've been doing this, again, 17 years. First of all, understand it is more difficult to get people to give you their time than their money in 2025. That was the case in 2008 when I started. Okay, and what that means is you need to be worth it to them. And it's not just content quality. It's not just the quality of the content. It's the frequency is the most important thing. When people find a podcast, if they end up becoming long-term subscribers, someone that's going to listen to like most of what you put out, they don't want that disrupted. It becomes part of their life. And so there are probably people that only listen to expert counsel shows like today for me. They don't really care for me by myself. Or they only listen to interviews. Or they only listen to my standalone shows. Or they pick and choose. But what they know is they get four shows a week, and that means that minimum they're going to be able to pick one. And most people, I find when I talk to them, listen to either all my shows or they listen to more than one per week. Two a week, 3 a week, something like that. When I started out, I did 5 a week, audio only. And people were like, man, you're going to burn out. And I'm like, no, if you want to build something, you have to be there for people. And one show a week is going to move you slow. So I would say you want to be in the range of a minimum of 3 shows a week, especially when you're new, because you're going to suck, no matter how good you are. I mean, I was a professional speaker. I spoke at a lot of seminars and events and stuff like that. Business functions, I was a great public speaker. It's still a new craft. Now, I did learn it driving in a car and actually podcasting to a little recorder while I was driving a car. That made it a little bit more difficult, but you should do that show a lot, a good frequency. But if you want to do once a week, okay, fine. You do not miss it. Then you do not freaking miss it, because then you're not worth my time to be a subscriber to you, okay? So you meet that commitment, whatever it is. But the more you do a week, nobody will listen in the beginning. No one's going to listen in the beginning. Now, if you start to build up and you start to get an audience, they may go back and listen from the beginning. But they're not really listening in the beginning. And that means you don't have to worry about messing up. And the more you do, the more you develop a rhythm, the more you'll develop your style, the more you'll figure things out, the better you'll get. And it will take you a dozen episodes to really start to feel that out, and that child starts to turn into a toddler and starts to crawl. And then it'll take about 20, 24 episodes where you get into, now you got a young child, you got an adolescent that can do things. And by then, you'll get really good. And what you, the other thing you should do is every show you do, listen to it. Listen to it without becoming depressed or down on yourself as a critic, though. I could have done this better. I could have said that better. I could have enunciated this better. That long pause was boring. That was a sidetrack. That's what I did. Every day I recorded the show in my car. I got to work. I uploaded it. I published it, and I did my job for 12 hours a day. I got out of the office. Sometimes I had to go client entertainment, shit like that, hang out with my partner, extra hour work. But when I got in my car to drive home, I hooked up my iPod, that's how long ago it is, to my car, and I listened to my own show in my car all the way back home. And I listened to it the way that when we used to play football in school and you had a game and you watched your game tapes, no matter how good you did, you looked for everything you did wrong. And not to the point of just being a critic for the sake of being a critic. What can I do better? Do that for, you know, 2-3 dozen episodes, and you'll get way, way good, way fast. Now, the person that asked me about this, that caused this to happen, is a physicist and wants to talk about, I think it's a fantastic subject. And so what you need to start doing is getting creative, though, with how do I make physics interesting, not just to people that are interested in physics, but people that are interested in life. People are interested in how things work. How do I make physics cool? How do I make physics, like, you're probably not going to sit there and explain long-form mathematical equations, because even a person into it will probably get bored. And it's just not an easy thing to follow. Now, maybe you do some of that on your YouTube channel, not necessarily as episodes, but as, you know, like extra stuff. Like, we'll actually do this today or whatever, right? But the power of podcasting, even for the people that will consume your podcast on YouTube or Rumble or Facebook or whatever, where that video is, the power is the audio. Everything that is the real power of the system is the audio. People do not really care what you look like. People will tend to, when you're doing a show, if you get into something where you're actually explaining something that is visual, if they're listening to the video, and that's what they're doing, they're listening, they will, like, okay, pause, and they'll come over and they'll look, rewind a little bit, and then watch it. And they'll go back to multitasking. Audio is the most powerful form of marketing and education tool in the world, because it's the one thing you can actually communicate to somebody with that they can truly multitask with. You can't do it with print, and you can't do it with video. People drive their car and listen to audio all the time. Some of them watch videos, they should, and that's dangerous, and they will never have their full attention. But people very quickly adapt. I'm doing this thing, and I can focus on this thing, but I can hear this sound, and I can do those two things at the same time. They do it in the gym. They do it taking a walk. They do it taking a run. They do it working on their gardens. You understand? Most of you that even tune into my video feeds, you are probably multitasking. You probably have a tab open. You're listening to it. It's on your phone, and you have earphones in or whatever, even though it's the video, it's YouTube or whatever. You're still doing something else. And again, then something will come up. Hey, we're actually showing this garden bed or something. Okay, you switch over to it. And this is why, if you go back to like the 80s and the 90s, before we had all this stuff, people spent thousands of dollars to order, you know, 5,000 cassette tapes to promote a product, bought a mailing list, and physically mailed them out to people. Because they knew if you sent them a tape, they're like, some high probability the person like, I might as well listen to this and plug it in their car. Once they started listening to it, if you hooked them in the first 5 minutes, they'd probably listen to the whole tape. They might not necessarily buy from you, but you would get their attention. Because audio can do that, and nothing else can do that. This is what makes podcasting so powerful. So I went way longer with this than I planned on. I hope it helps person that asked it. I hope it helps any, you know, baby or potential podcaster out there. But this is my philosophy, and this is what I built the show on. And the interesting thing is I've never hidden any of it. When I started the show, this is my, if there is a secret sauce, I involved the audience. I said, if you like the show, then you should help me promote it. Because if you want me to keep doing it, it needs to be successful. And if it becomes successful, it will become more than it is now. You can't start where I am. Not because I'm good, but because you haven't put the time in yet. They say it's 10,000 hours to become a master at something. 10,000 hours to master your craft. I crossed 10,000 hours, About 9 years ago. I remember kind of doing the math and figuring out when I was going to do it and talking about it. 10,000 hours. You can't replace that. And there's a reason for that number that I won't get into today, but there's, and it doesn't matter if it's being a blacksmith, a computer programmer, a speaker, right, a writer, 10,000 hours in your craft of quality work, that's what will lead to mastery of your craft. And that means that the first step is the hardest, but you got to take it. With that, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up. Thanks for tuning in today. Remember, next week will be all TSP Rewinds, because I have 80 people descending upon the Spirico household for TSP 25 workshop. If you're coming, I can't wait to see you. Once we get done with next week with those rewinds, we will be back and on the attack all the way up to Thanksgiving with regular scheduled programming. Unless something goes wrong, we will be once again live streaming all the presentations for free and maybe some of the karaoke nonsense in the evenings, which is really late at night. Again, sometimes things go wrong. I don't sell it because that way if something goes wrong, you can complain, but no one will care. But we try to live stream all of our presentations. We do not live stream things that happen outside, like walkthroughs and stuff. It's too complicated. It's too hard. It takes too much work. But we use the same software, StreamYard, that I use for the podcasts I just talked about. And so if you get on the TSP channel, I will be for YouTube. And if you are on our Telegram channel, we'll be announcing like where you can find these streams. So like we have a great lineup of speakers. We have some people that we've never had before. Sonny Pazikas, who was a member of the Russian military and trains in self-defense and things like that. And he lives only about 2 hours away from me now. Really great dude. He'll be presenting. Alan Booker, one of the smartest people you ever meet. An engineer with a permaculture education that teaches permaculture to engineers, but he's also switched on with economics like you will not believe. I have him doing two presentations plus being on a panel with me. We have Joel Riles speaking. We have a ton of great speakers, Nicole Sauce, etc. You can see them all at no cost. Just have to tune into YouTube, and they will be. I get it all the time. Well, if I miss the live, well, like, yes, you'll be able to see it. Come on now. Of course, why would I take it down? I don't do that. They're up for the past like 5 years. And StreamYard's the magic. That's why I recommend it for podcasters. It was such a pain in the ass videoing the things and then uploading it. The huge files, 3 days, 6 presentations a day, an hour long each. That's a lot of shit to deal with. StreamYard, boom, it's there. So that's what you have to look forward to next week. So if you don't like rewinds, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, you got live stream presentations 5 a day. With that, take care. I'll catch you guys not next week, the following. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month.